One final speaker before we go to the perhaps the most important part of the program, the discussion. But I want to remind you that this is a workshop, not a talking shop. We hope to be able to come away from this with some ideas as to what to do. We have people who would like to tell us what is to be done, but we prefer if it comes from the audience. There are some suggestions. We know that a number of you who are students here, if not here, you're on campuses in Maryland and in Massachusetts and elsewhere, that the FBI and the CIA and the ROTC and all other institutions of the military are recruiting on these campuses. And you might want to think about that. Do they belong on your campuses? Mind you, I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm throwing out a question. Do they belong on the campuses? Do these killer machines, which are killing our people even as we speak, belong on institutions of higher learning? What is higher learning about being in the FBI and the CIA and the ROTC? You ask yourself that question. And in the spirit of Malcolm, you don't simply ask the question. You would, in the spirit of the title of this workshop, you resist it, and you begin to do something about it. So think about that as we go along. As I said before at the beginning, 48% of the women who are in the Gulf today are black women. They're African women, many of whom have left their children here and their men wearing aprons back at home while they go off to war to kill other brown women. It is something to think about. They love to, they're encouraging people to write to our boys in the Gulf. I think you ought to write to them. I think you ought to send them cassette tapes. I think you ought to send them pictures of our relations with the police department in the cities of New York and things of that nature. I think you ought to help the war effort. I think you ought to do those things. You don't have to take care. I'm just saying, think about it. Something to think about. I also think that you need to think in terms of, should a colony be forced to send its sons and daughters to fight other people who are simply trying to maintain their own sovereignty? If you think it's okay, then don't struggle to stop the Puerto Ricans from being sent from Puerto Rico to the Gulf. So far, 400 Puerto Ricans have been drafted into the Gulf area that I know of, not the ones from the United States, I'm talking from Puerto Rico. 400 Puerto Ricans have been sent off to the Gulf area. This, you know, if you think that's okay, well, you know, and don't do anything about it. If you think it's something that we ought to struggle against, then you need to raise it up right on the campuses, on with the elected officials and whatnot. So think about those and some other things. We'll talk about some additional ones as we go along. At this point, I'd like to introduce the final speaker, a sister and a comrade, a friend, who is a Palestinian, who is not only deeply involved in her own struggle, but is in solidarity with all of the other people's struggles around the world, Sister Rabab Hadi. I should also mention that she's also a journalist that, you know, a reporter at the United Nations and writes for a publication, Palestine Focus, which is available downstairs if you'd like to get more information. Rabab.
Good afternoon, sisters and brothers. I would like first to thank the organizers of this conference for putting together this conference, because we need to remember and reflect on the legacy of Malcolm and how we should carry the work forward. And I think in the question and answer period, we will be able to draft some suggestions to the organizers to go out of it with some proposals for the future. And before I start, I'd like to pass around this sign-up sheet for those of you who'd like to receive some information on the Palestinian struggle. Please list it, and then we can stay in touch. I have a difficult job today. I'm supposed to talk about Palestine, the Middle East, the Gulf crisis, and U.S. foreign policy there within a very short period of time, but I will try. The Gulf crisis has alerted our attention on August 2nd when Iraqi forces invaded Kuwait. On August 3rd at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. in the morning, the United States moved in the Security Council of the United Nations, was able to get a resolution passed condemning the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Within couple of weeks, the United States has been able to obtain about 5 resolutions condemning Iraq, considering its annexation of Kuwait illegal, imposing an embargo, economic sanctions, and committing its troops to Saudi Arabia. 250,000 going to be 350,000, as Dick Cheney tells us. On October 8th, Israeli forces, army, police, and border patrol surrounded the Aqsa Mosque of Jerusalem, the third holiest place of Islam, killed 26 Palestinians, including a woman who died of tear gas inhalation, produced here in the United States in Salisbury, Pennsylvania, injured 850 Palestinians, detained 1,000, prohibited people going to hospitals to donate blood to help the injured, and denied people access to visit and find out what's happening to their relatives. 2 versions of the story in Jerusalem emerged. One was a Palestinian saying that Palestinians were gathered there to protect the Aqsa Mosque from the Temple Mount faithful, which is an Israeli extremist group that was trying to destroy Haram Sharif, Al-Aqsa Mosque, and establish the second temple in Jerusalem. They were gathered there, they were attacked, they threw rocks, the police shot and injured. The Israeli story said that the Palestinians were provoked by a plan, a conspiracy by the Palestine Liberation Organization to divert attention from the Gulf crisis. The United Nations Security Council moved to adopt a plan to send a fact-finding mission to Jerusalem to find out what exactly happened there. The United States spent 5 days obstructing the resolution and trying to stop it from being passed in order to shield its friend and ally in the Middle East, Israel. After long debate, a watered-down version of the resolution was passed. The Israeli government rejected accepting the United Nations fact-finding mission. We've yet to see any passing of sanctions or an embargo against Israel with the Security Council, according to the United States claims that it supports human rights, democracy, and peace throughout the world, specifically in the same region that it adopted few resolutions of the United Nations against Iraq. Fortunately, there were human rights organizations in Israel as well as Palestinians who came out substantiating the Palestinian story. And maybe that's why Israel is refusing to accept the fact-finding mission, because it would prove them wrong. It makes us raise a few questions about U.S. policy, which I would agree with all the panelists, and the title of this panel is a racist war that aims at increasing the benefits and the profits of the multinational corporations and getting rid of more third world people. Let's look at the two situations. An occupation of Iraq, of Kuwait by Iraq, 3 months old, 9 Security Council resolutions, an embargo, 250,000 forces in Saudi Arabia. A 23-year-old Israeli occupation of Palestinian and other Arab lands that has killed, maimed, injured, destroyed homes, made people homeless, displaced them, massacres after massacres, nothing is done. If the United States is serious about rolling back occupations, then why don't we see the same treatment? Why there isn't one yardstick for all? Why the United States has been also denying a resolution of the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara? Don't forget about that. There are people in the Sahrawi Arab Republic fighting for their self-determination. And the United States has continuously supported Morocco because it is lucky in North Africa to suppress their struggle for self-determination. There has to be one yardstick for all occupations. And the United States has no right to talk about moral high standards, because as Esmeralda has told you, about the other comrades have told you, just a few months ago it invaded Panama. And in 1983 it invaded Grenada. And if we are going to talk about abiding by Security Council resolutions, let's look at the sanctions that were imposed on the apartheid regime in South Africa. There were sanctions imposed. Have we seen United States navies surrounding the apartheid regime trying to impose the embargo? Or have we seen the United States shielding many powers, including Israel, who are busting the sanctions imposed on South Africa? Where is the same standard for all? The question of human rights and democracy in the Middle East. Yes, Saddam Hussein is no champion of human rights. Yes, he did gas the Kurdish population to deny them right to self-determination. He has waged a war against Iran just 1 year after the Iranian revolution succeeded, preventing any breath for the Iranian people to consolidate the gains and have democracy in their own nation, provided at the time Khomeini regime to suppress the opposition claiming that they are spies for the enemy, Iraq, and allowed him also to suppress his own opposition. But the United States knew that. And you have been told before, at the International Convention for the Elimination of Chemical Weapons in Paris, the United States chose to turn the other way and not to talk about Iraq's violations of human rights. But let's look at Iraq's adversaries in this war. Kuwait, a royal family that has been ruling for 200 years by so-called divine right, that has scratched the emir, the prince, has scratched the democratically elected parliament because members of the parliament have started to investigate charges of corruption by his government, which happens to be his royal family also, has jailed the opposition not long time ago, a few months ago. And of all the Arab countries that allow a vote, democratic vote, Kuwait is the only one that doesn't allow women to vote. Let's not even address the situation of Saudi Arabia, where women are not even allowed to drive a car. There are no elections. There is no democratic freedom. People are not allowed to speak up their minds. And Amnesty International has reports after reports talking about how they treat opposition there. The torture, the elimination, the total disappearance of opposition. Egypt, which has jailed the president of the League of Human Rights in the Arab world. Not even some opposition, the president of the League of Human Rights in the Arab world. And continues to jail and torture the opposition. The majority of the population is starving. $50 billion debt to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And Israel, which, as I have told you, has a great record in human rights. I wouldn't even have the time to recite all of it right now. But you know. All these regimes, as I said, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and Israel, as well as Syria because of its rivalry with Iraq, have supported U.S. intervention. Let's look at those countries who have went against U.S. intervention. What is the nature of those countries within the context of democracy and human rights? Algeria, which has undergone a democratic election not long ago. Tunisia, the same thing. Jordan, and Jordan is a very interesting case because people keep wondering why King Hussein, who was on the CIA payroll in the 70s, and has upset Mr. Bush so much because he was the director. He was the one who was writing his checks for him. Why did King Hussein turn against the United States? King Hussein, who in 1970 massacred 20,000 Palestinians, who had an operation room both in Tel Aviv and in Washington, standing by to see if they can save him if the Palestinians succeed, along with the Jordanian Democratic Forces, in overturning his regime. Why is he taking this independent national position against U.S. intervention? There is a very important factor here. In April of 1989, there was an uprising in Jordan, by Jordanians, by the way, in the Bedouin cities of Jordan, calling for end of corruption in the government, for government subsidies of daily staples, because Jordan also has a very high debt, $8 billion to the IMF. And the IMF was saying, we will extend the loans to you if you will withdraw the government subsidies of the daily staples. And people wanted to speak up their minds, like everybody around the world. Everybody cherishes freedom. So the king, in order to save his rule, had to allow democratic elections. And they were, interesting enough, fair and democratic elections. Nobody expected that to happen, but they were. And as a result of that, there are popular sentiments in Jordan that the king cannot ignore. So he has to respond to the popular sentiments of the people and adopt a national independent position against U.S. intervention in the region. What about the Palestinians? The Palestinians also adopted a position that is not supportive of Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. As a matter of fact, in the beginning, before U.S. intervened and submitted its troops, the Palestinians were against, strongly against the occupation of Kuwait. But the U.S. intervention tipped off the whole balance, because here you have a superpower that has not been a friend of Arabs attacking an Arab country. And all Arabs will stand in the defense of Iraq because it's being attacked by the United States. The PLO has called for mediation, has called for an Arab solution that comes from the region, has not called for outside intervention. The U.S. media chose to portray anybody who's against U.S. intervention as immediately supporting everything that Saddam Hussein stands for. Far from it, the Palestinians who have been undergoing a democratic process, not only since the Intifada began on December 9, 1987, but a long, long time ago, but it was catalyzed by the Intifada, which is a genuine mass popular movement of all the population, women and men, children and the elderly, cross-class, cross-religious backgrounds, cross-ethnic backgrounds, all of them united in their quest for freedom and independence. As a matter of fact, the Palestinian Declaration of Independence calls for a state that is democratic, that is secular, that is multi-party, that has no discrimination on the basis of sex, race, religion, or national background. This genuine movement is represented by the PLO, has chosen not to support U.S. intervention also in the region. This is the contrast in the Middle East. This is the polarization of forces in the Middle East. It is between those who are totally dependent on the United States, who are collaborating with the United States in order to reap the fruits of the resources in the region, oil and otherwise, for the benefit of U.S. oil companies and multinational corporations, against those who are seeking democracy, human rights, self-determination, and a better economic and social justice life for their children. This is what's happening in our region. Another point that this crisis brings up is the question of Arab unity. Yes, the borders between Arab countries were artificially drawn up by colonialist powers. In 1916, French Foreign Minister Picot and British Foreign Minister Sykes met together and drew up the Sykes-Picot Accord, which only became well known after the October Revolution succeeded in Russia and they had gotten the archives from the Tsar's, archives, whatever, and they released them to the world. And they divided the Arab world between both of them in order to exploit the people and the resources of the region. There were not borders, there was nothing called the State of Kuwait, nothing called the United Arab Emirates, small little, areas that the colonial powers basically put in power after they divided to ensure that they satisfy each of those local, lackeys and ensure that they can continue exploiting while these people stay in power. But how do we achieve Arab unity? Arab people are for Arab unity. These are the sentiments. We need it. It's not a question also only of aspirations and dreams. It's also, it is very much needed in order to share the wealth, the resources, and in order to have a viable economy and better life. It is needed to unite the Arab world. But also the unity has to happen a process from the grassroots up. And there is an example in the Arab world. There is the unity of the two Yemens that had just happened this year, which took a long time, but it was an emerging process between two nations from the bottom up that have decided to unite, have worked together and integrated the economy and all the institutions. Not like the unities that happened from the top down. And you remember so many of them in the Arab world, maybe. Egypt and Syria in 1958, Libya and Morocco at one time, Libya and Sudan at another, Libya, Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco at one time. If it doesn't happen from the bottom up as an expression of the people's sentiments, it doesn't last. This is how it should happen. Why are Arab people against the US intervention in the region? And who benefits from this intervention? If you recall the history of US policy in the Middle East, as late as 1958, the United States submitted its troops in Lebanon to crush a popular uprising by the Lebanese population, Marines at the time. The United States was willing to use nuclear power twice, at least as far as I know. I'm sure there are more, and the archives will let us know in the future. In 1970, when the Jordanian regime was being threatened, and in 1973, during the October War between Israel on one hand, Syria and Egypt on the other, at least. In 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, killing 20,000 people, injuring at least 40,000, displacing 100,000, the United States shielded Israel, replaced its weaponry of cluster bombs and the rest of the destructive weapons, and sent its troops into Beirut, claiming that they were going to provide safeguard for the Palestinian population. We know what happened. Sabra and Shatila massacres, September 17, 1982. The United States has shielded Israel when it bombed the PLO headquarters in Tunis, when it killed the second in command of the PLO, Abu Jihad, and when it continues day in and day out to bomb and terrorize the refugee camps in Lebanon, hijack Arab planes here and there, and violate Palestinian rights in the occupied territories, refuses to withdraw so people can achieve their right to self-determination, and violates even one of the laws of the United States that says any country that receives military weapons of the U.S. cannot send it to a third country unless it notifies the United States. The U.S. claims that it doesn't know that Israel sends weapons to South Africa, to the Contras in Nicaragua, Duvalier in Haiti when he was there, Marcos in the Philippines, the Guatemalans who Sharon went there in 1982 to talk about the Palestinization of the Indian population, UNITA in Angola, we don't have time. Or the fact that Israel receives $4 billion a year of U.S. aid, added to 700 million just recently. That is not counting the benefits that are cushioned in the Pentagon bill. And the $400 million that the U.S. provided to Israel to settle Soviet Jews that are coming to our area to replace Palestinians and expel them out of their land. And Israel made a promise that they will not settle Soviet Jews in the occupied territories or East Jerusalem. But once the Israeli foreign minister, David Levy, arrived in Jerusalem, he said, no, we didn't make any promises like that. The money, meanwhile, keeps on going. Just to conclude, I would submit to you that the beneficiaries of the U.S. intervention in the Middle East are not the democratic human rights forces, whether in the Middle East or here, who are fighting for a better life. It is the oil companies, and I don't need to remind you that Mr. Bush is a large shareholder in the oil companies. It is the military industries who, before August 2nd, There was a big talk about slashing the military budget. Talk about the peace dividend, you know, nobody's talking about that anymore. The fact that this conflict has shielded Mr. Bush and his son Neil from the saving and loan scandal, as another son now, nobody's talking about that. The fact that the majority of the forces in the Gulf are of third world people, sent as a cannon fodder to kill other third world people. This crisis is not helping anyone. What is the solution then? We were asked to come up with some suggestions. I think the only way to avoid this crisis, maybe not to resolve on a strategic basis, but just this crisis, is to immediately demand the withdrawal of all U.S. forces from the Gulf. Immediately. Secondly, is to demand a peaceful, non-military, political solution to all the conflicts in the region. One conflict is not more important than another. And actually, the most underlying conflict in the region is the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. As long as it's not resolved, based on the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination, in a state of their own, led by their representative, the PLO, the problems in the region will continue to fester. They will not be resolved. We can call for a solution like that within the United Nations the way we envision the United Nations, not as a tool of the United States. United Nations. Talk about all the United Nations resolutions, not the one that the United States likes. There have been numerous resolutions condemning U.S. bombing of Libya, U.S. invasion of Panama, of Grenada, and so on and so forth. Why be choosy? Let's talk about all of them. And let's talk about one yardstick for all. I'm not saying that they're going to listen. But I think this is one way maybe to address what is going on and to put the debate back on the way it's supposed to be. Another thing is we have to stop the flow of arms to the Middle East. The United States is sending more and more military weapons to the Middle East, and it's not going to help the process of peace, democracy, human rights, social and economic justice in our region. And it's not going to help people here either. It is to kill. Weapons are made to kill. And we don't want any more weapons because they are, and if you look at them, where are they going? To Israel, to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt, to the monarchies? We don't want them. We don't need to buy more weapons and more consumer goods in our area and exploit our resources and not develop alternative economies. The bottom line is U.S. intervention in our region has to stop. We have to be able to enter a process in order to build our economies, because our children, and when I talk about our children, I'm not just talking about Arab children, I'm talking about the children all over. Third world people all over the world have suffered enough. Maybe by addressing this crisis, we can be on the right path to provide a better future for them. Thank you.